because I want to get through this, to set the record straight, to take all the blame I should, and then I want to tell you what I hinted at on the phone the other night. About how you've discovered what the vanishings are all about. He held up a hand. Don't get ahead of me. Sorry, she said, putting her hand over her mouth. But why don't you just let me hear it when you answer Buck's questions tonight? Rayford rolled his eyes. I was just wondering, she said. Just a suggestion so you don't have to repeat yourself. Thank you, he said. But I'll tell you why. This is so important and so personal that I need to tell you privately, and I don't mind telling it over and over. And if my guess is right, you won't mind hearing it again and again. Hattie raised her eyebrows as if to say she would be surprised, but she said, You have the floor. I won't interrupt again. Rayford leaned forward and rested his elbows on his knees, gesturing as he spoke. Hattie, I owe you a huge apology, and I want your forgiveness. We were friends. We enjoyed each other's company. I loved being with you and spending time with you. I found you beautiful and exciting, and I think you know I was interested in a relationship with you. She looked surprised, but Rayford assumed that, had it not been for her pledge of silence, she would have told him he had a pretty laid-back way of showing interest. He continued, Probably the only reason I never pursued anything further with you was because I didn't have any experience in such things. But it was only a matter of time. If I had found you willing, I'd have eventually done something wrong. She furrowed her brow and looked offended. Yes, he said, it would have been wrong. I was married, not happily and not successfully, but that was my fault. Still, I had made a vow, a commitment, and no matter how I justified my interest in you, it would have been wrong. He could tell from her look that she disagreed. Anyway, I led you on. I wasn't totally honest. But now I have to tell you how grateful I am that I didn't do something, well, stupid. It would not have been right for you, either. I know I'm not your judge and jury, and your morals are your own decision, but there would have been no future for us. It isn't just that we're so far apart in age, but the fact is that the only real interest I had in you was physical. You have a right to hate me for that, and I'm not proud of it. I did not love you. You have to agree that would have been no kind of a life for you. She nodded, appearing to cloud up. He smiled. I'll let you break your silence temporarily, he said. I need to know that you at least forgive me.
Sometimes I wonder if honesty is always the best policy, she said. I might have been able to accept this if you had just said your wife's disappearance made you feel guilty about what we had going. I know we didn't really have anything going yet, but that would have been a kinder way to put it.
Kinder, but dishonest. Hattie, I'm through being dishonest. Everything in me would rather be kind and gentle and keep you from resenting me, but I just can't be phony anymore. I was not genuine for years.
And now you are?
To the point where it's unattractive to you, he said. She nodded again. Why would I want to do that? Everybody likes to be liked. I could have blamed this on something else, on my wife, whatever. But I want to be able to live with myself. I want to be able to convince you, when I talk about even more important things, that I have no ulterior motives. Hattie's lips quivered. She pressed them together and looked down, a tear rolling down her cheek. It was all Rayford could do to keep from embracing her. There would be nothing sensual about it, but he couldn't afford to give a wrong signal. Hattie, he said, I'm so sorry. Forgive me. She nodded, unable to speak. She tried to say something, but couldn't regain her composure. Now, after all that, Rayford said, I somehow have to convince you that I do care for you as a friend and as a person. Hattie held up both hands, fighting not to cry. She shook her head as if not ready for this.
Don't, she managed. Not right now.
Hattie, I've got to.
Please, give me a minute.
Take your time, but don't run from me now, he said. I would be no friend if I didn't tell you what I've found, what I've learned, what I'm discovering more of each day. Hattie buried her face in her hands and cried.
I wasn't going to do this, she said. I wasn't going to give you the satisfaction.
Rayford spoke as tenderly as he could. Now you're going to offend me, he said. If you take nothing else from this conversation, you must know that your tears give me no satisfaction. Every one of them is a dagger to me. I'm responsible. I was wrong.
Give me a minute, she said, hurrying off.
Rayford dug out Irene's Bible and quickly scanned some passages. He had decided not to sit talking to Hattie with the Bible open. He didn't want to embarrass or intimidate her, despite his newfound courage and determination. You're going to find my dad's theory of the disappearings very interesting, Chloe said. Am I? Buck said. She nodded, and he noticed a dab of chocolate at the corner of her mouth. He said, May I? Extending his hand. She raised her chin, and he transferred the chocolate to his thumb. Now what should he do? Wipe it on a napkin? Impulsively, he put his thumb to his lips.
Gross, she said. How embarrassing. What if I have the creeping crud or something?
Then now we've both got it, he said, and they laughed. Buck realized he was blushing, something he hadn't done for years, and so he changed the subject. You say your dad's theory as if maybe it's not yours, too. Do you two disagree?
He thinks we do, because I argue with him and give him a hard time about it. I just don't want to be too easy to convince. But if I had to be honest, I'd have to say we're pretty close. See, he thinks that...
Buck held up a hand. Oh, I'm sorry, don't tell me. I want to get it fresh from him, on tape.
Oh, excuse me.
No, it's okay. I didn't mean to embarrass you, but that's just how I like to work. I'd love to hear your theory, too. We're going to get some college kids' ideas, but it would be unlikely we would use two people from the same family. Of course, you just told me that you pretty much agree with your father, so I'd better wait and hear them both at the same time.
She had fallen silent and looked serious.
I'm sorry, Chloe. I didn't mean to imply I'm not interested in your theory.
It's not that, she said. But you just kind of categorized me there.
Categorized you?
As a college kid.
Ooh, I did, didn't I? My fault. I know better. Collegians aren't kids.
I don't see you as a kid, although you are a lot younger than I am. Collegians? I haven't heard that term in a while.
I am showing my age, aren't I?
How old are you, Buck?
30 and a half, going on 31, he said with a twinkle.
I say, how old are you?
She shouted, as if talking to a deaf old man. Buck roared. I'd buy you another cookie, little girl, but I don't want to spoil your appetite.
You'd better not. My dad loves good food, and he's buying tonight. Save room.
I will, Chloe.
Can I tell you something without you thinking I'm weird? She said.
Too late, he said. She frowned and punched him.
I was just going to say that I like the way you say my name.
I didn't know there was any other way to say it, he said.
Oh, there is. Even my friends slip into making it one syllable, like Cloy.
Chloe, he repeated.
Yeah, she said. Like that. Two syllables. Long O, long E.
I like your name. He slipped into an old man's husky voice. It's a young person's name. How old are you, kid?
20 and a half, going on 21.
Oh, my goodness, he said, still in character. I'm consorting with a minor.
As they headed back toward the Pan Con Club, Chloe said, If you promise not to make a big deal of my youth, I won't make a big deal of your age.
Deal, he said, a smile playing at his lips. You play a lot older.
I'll take that as a compliment, she said, smiling self-consciously, as if she wasn't sure he was serious.
Oh, do, he said. Few people your age are as well-read and articulate as you are.
That was definitely a compliment, she said. You catch on quick.
Did you really interview Nikolai Carpathia?
He nodded. We're almost buddies.
No kidding?
Well, not really, but we hit it off.
Tell me about him.
And so Buck did. Hattie returned, slightly refreshed, but still puffy-eyed, and sat again as if she were ready for more punishment. Rayford reiterated that he was sincere about his apology, and she said,
Let's just put that behind us, shall we?
I need to know that you forgive me, he said.
You seem really hung up on that, Rayford. Would that let you off the hook, ease your conscience?
I guess maybe it would, he said. Mostly it would tell me you believe I'm sincere.
I believe it, she said. It doesn't make it any more pleasant or easier to take, but if it makes you feel better, I do believe you mean it, and I don't hold grudges, so I guess that's forgiveness.
I'll take what I can get, he said. Now, I want to be very honest with you.
Uh-oh, there's more? Or is this where you educate me about what happened last week?
Yeah, this is it. But I need to tell you that Chloe advised against getting into this right now.
In the same conversation as the other, you mean?
Right.
Smart girl, she said. We must understand each other.
Well, you're not that far apart in age.
Wrong thing to say, Rayford. If you were going to use that you're young enough to be my daughter approach, you should have brought it up earlier.
Not unless I fathered you when I was 15, Rayford said. Anyway, Chloe is convinced you're not going to be in the mood for this just now.
Why? Does this require some reaction? Do I have to buy into your idea or something?
That's my hope, but no. If it's something you can't handle right now, I'll understand, but I think you'll see the urgency of it. Rayford felt much like Bruce Barnes had sounded the day they met. He was full of passion and persuasion, and he felt his prayers for courage and coherence were answered as he spoke. He told Hattie of his history with God, having been raised in a church-going home, and how he and Irene had attended various churches throughout their marriage. He even told her that Irene's preoccupation with end-time events had been one thing that made him consider looking elsewhere for companionship. Rayford could tell by Hattie's look that she knew where he was going, that he had now come to agree with Irene and had bought the whole package. Hattie sat motionless as he told the story of knowing what he would find at home that morning after they landed at O'Hare. He told her of calling the church, meeting Bruce, Bruce's story, the videotape, their studies, the prophecies from the Bible, the preachers in Israel that clearly paralleled the two witnesses spoken of in Revelation. Rayford told her how he had prayed the prayer with the pastor as the videotape rolled, and how he now felt so responsible for Chloe and wanted her to find God, too. Hattie stared at him. Nothing in her body language or expression encouraged him, but he kept going. He didn't ask her to pray with him. He simply told her he would no longer apologize for what he believed. You can see at least how if a person truly accepts this, he must tell other people. He would be no friend if he didn't. Hattie wouldn't even give him the satisfaction of a nod to concede that point. After nearly half an hour, he exhausted his new knowledge, and he concluded, Hattie, I want you to think about it. Consider it. Watch the tape. Talk to Bruce if you want to. I can't make you believe. All I can do is make you aware of what I have come to accept as the truth. I care about you and wouldn't want you to miss out simply because no one ever told you. Finally, Hattie sat back and sighed.
Well, that's sweet, Rayford. It really is. I appreciate your telling me all that.
It hits me real strange and different because I never knew that stuff was in the Bible. My family went to church when I was a kid, mostly on holidays or if we got invited, but I never heard anything like that. I will think about it. I sort of have to. Once you hear something like this, it's hard to put it out of your mind for a while. Is this what you're going to tell Buck Williams at dinner?
Word for word. She chuckled.
Wonder if any of it will find its way into his magazine.
Probably along with space aliens, germ gas, and death rays, Rayford said. Chapter 21 When Buck and Chloe reconnected with Hattie and Chloe's father, it was clear Hattie had been crying. Buck didn't feel close enough to ask what was wrong, and she never offered. Buck was glad for the opportunity to interview Rayford Steele, but his emotions were mixed. The reactions of the captain who had piloted the plane on which he had been a passenger when the disappearances occurred would add drama to his story. But even more, he wanted to spend time with Chloe. Buck would run back to the office, then home to change and meet them later at the Carlisle. At the office, he took a call from Stanton Bailey asking how soon he could go to Chicago to get Lucinda Washington replaced.
Soon, but I don't want to miss developments at the UN.
Everything happening there tomorrow morning you already know about from Plank, Bailey said. Word I get is it's already starting to come down. Plank assumes his new position in the morning, denies Carpathia's interest, reiterates what it would take, and we all wait and see if anybody bites. I don't think they will.
I wish they would, Buck said, still hoping he could trust Carpathia and eager to see what the man would do about Stonegal and Todd Cawthron.
I do too, Bailey said, but what are the odds? He's a man for this time, but his global disarmament and his reorganization plans are too ambitious. It'll never happen.
I know, but if you were deciding, wouldn't you go along with it?
Yeah, Bailey said, sighing. I probably would. I'm so tired of war and violence. I'd probably even go for moving the place to this new Babylon.
Maybe the UN delegates will be smart enough to know the world is ready for Carpathia, Buck said.
Wouldn't that be too good to be true, Bailey said. Don't bet the farm or hold your breath or whatever it is you're not supposed to do when the odds are against you.
Buck told his new boss he would fly to Chicago the next morning and get back to New York by Sunday night.
I'll get the lay of the land, find out who's solid in Chicago and whether we need to look at outside applicants.
I'd prefer staying inside, Bailey said. But it's my style to let you make those decisions.
Buck phoned Pancon Airlines, knowing Rayford Steele's flight left at 8 the next morning. He told the reservation clerk his traveling companion was Chloe Steele.
Yes, she said. Miss Steele is flying complimentary in first class. There is a seat open next to her. Will you be a guest of the crew as well?
No.
He booked a cheap seat and charged it to the magazine, then upgraded to the seat next to Chloe. He would say nothing that night about going to Chicago. It had been ages since Buck had worn a tie, but this was, after all, the Carlisle Hotel dining room. He wouldn't have gotten in without one. Fortunately, they were directed to a private table in a little alcove where he could stash his bag without appearing gauche. His table mates assumed he needed the bag for his equipment, not aware he had packed a change of clothes, too. Chloe was radiant, looking 5 years older in a classy evening dress. It was clear she and Hattie had spent the late afternoon in a beauty salon. Rayford thought his daughter looked stunning that evening, and he wondered what the magazine writer thought of her. Clearly, this Williams guy was too old for her. Rayford had spent his free hours before dinner napping and then praying that he would have the same courage and clarity he had had with Hattie. He had no idea what she thought, except that he was sweet for telling her everything. He wasn't sure whether that was sarcasm or condescension. He could only hope he had gotten through. That she had spent time alone with Chloe might have been good. Rayford hoped Chloe wasn't so antagonistic and close-minded that she had become an ally against him with Hattie. At the restaurant, Williams seemed to gaze at Chloe and ignore Hattie. Rayford considered this insensitive, but it didn't seem to bother Hattie. Maybe Hattie was matchmaking behind his back. Rayford himself had said nothing about Hattie's new look for the evening, but that was by design. She was striking and always had been, but he was not going down that path again. During dinner, Rayford kept the conversation light. Buck said to let him know when he was ready to be interviewed. After dessert, Rayford spoke to the waiter privately. "We'd like to spend another hour or so here, if that's all right."
"Sir, we do have an extensive reservation list."
"I wouldn't want this table to be less than profitable for you," Rayford said, pressing a large bill into the waiter's palm. "So boot us out whenever it becomes necessary."
The waiter peeked at the bill and slipped it into his pocket.
"I'm sure you will not be disturbed," he said. And the water glasses were always full. Rayford enjoyed answering Williams's initial questions about his job, his training, his background, and upbringing. But he was eager to get on with his new mission in life. And finally, the question came. Buck tried to concentrate on the captain's answers, but felt himself trying to impress Chloe, too. Everyone in the business knew he was one of the best in the world at interviewing. That and his ability to quickly sift through the stuff and make a readable, engaging article of it had made him who he was. Buck had breezed through the preliminaries, and he liked this guy. Steele seemed honest and sincere, smart and articulate. He realized he had seen a lot of Rayford in Chloe. "I'm ready," he said, "to ask your idea of what happened on that fateful flight to London. Do you have a theory?" The captain hesitated and smiled as if gathering himself.
"I have more than a theory," he said. "You may think this sounds crazy coming from a technically minded person like me, but I believe I have found the truth and know exactly what happened."
Buck knew this would play well in the magazine.
"Gotta appreciate a man who knows his mind," he said. "Here's your chance to tell the world."
Chloe chose that moment to gently touch Buck's arm and asked if he minded if she excused herself for a moment.
"I'll join you," Hattie said.
Buck smiled, watching them go. "What was that?" he said. "A conspiracy? Were they supposed to leave me alone with you, or have they heard this before and don't want to rehash it?" Rayford was privately frustrated, almost to the point of anger. That was the second time in a few hours that Chloe had somehow been spirited away at a crucial time.
"I assure you that is not the case," he said, forcing himself to smile.
He couldn't slow down and wait for their return. The question had been asked, he felt ready, and so he stepped off the edge of a social cliff, saying things he knew could get him categorized as a kook. As he had done with Hattie, he outlined his own spotty spiritual history and brought Williams up to the present in a little over half an hour, covering every detail he felt was relevant. At some point, the women returned. Buck sat without interrupting as this most lucid and earnest professional calmly propounded a theory that only 3 weeks before Buck would have found absurd. It sounded like things he had heard in church and from friends, but this guy had chapter and verse from the Bible to back it up. And this business of the two preachers in Jerusalem representing two witnesses predicted in the book of Revelation? Buck was aghast. He finally broke in.
"That's interesting," he said. "Have you heard the latest?"
Buck told him what he had seen on CNN during his few brief minutes at his apartment. "Apparently thousands are making some sort of a pilgrimage to the Wailing Wall. They're lined up for miles trying to get in and hear the preaching. Many are converting and going out themselves to preach. The authorities seem powerless to keep them out, despite the opposition of the Orthodox Jews. Anyone who comes against the preachers is struck dumb or paralyzed, and many of the old Orthodox guard are joining forces with the preachers."
"Amazing," the pilot responded. "But even more amazing, it was all predicted in the Bible."
Buck was desperate to maintain his composure. He wasn't sure what he was hearing, but Steele was impressive. Maybe the man was reaching to link Bible prophecy with what was happening in Israel, but no one else had an explanation. What Steele had read to Buck from Revelation appeared clear. Maybe it was wrong, maybe it was mumbo-jumbo, but it was the only theory that tied the incident so closely to any sort of explanation. What else would give Buck this constant case of the chills? Buck focused on Captain Steele, his pulse racing, looking neither right nor left. He could not move. He was certain the women could hear his crashing heart. Was all this possible? Could it be true? Had he been exposed to a clear work of God in the destruction of the Russian Air Corps just to set him up for a moment like this? Could he shake his head and make it all go away? Could he sleep on it and come to his senses in the morning? Would a conversation with Bailey or Plank set him straight, snap him out of his silliness? He sensed not. Something about this demanded attention. He wanted to believe something that tied everything together and made it make sense, but Buck also wanted to believe in Nikolai Carpathia. Maybe Buck was going through a scary time where he was vulnerable to impressive people. That wasn't like him, but then, who was himself these days? Who could be expected to be himself during times like these? Buck didn't want to rationalize this away, to talk himself out of it. He wanted to ask Rayford Steele about his own sister-in-law and niece and nephew, but that would be personal. That would not relate to the story he was working on. This had not begun as a personal quest, a search for truth. This was merely a fact-finding mission, an element in a bigger story. In no way did Buck even begin to think he was going to pick a favorite theory and espouse it as Global Weekly's position. He was supposed to round up all the theories, from the plausible to the bizarre. Readers would add their own in the letters column, or they would make a decision based on the credibility of the sources. This airline pilot, unless Buck made him look like a lunatic, would come off profound and convincing. For the first time in his memory, Buck Williams was speechless. Rayford was certain he was not getting through. He only hoped this writer was astute enough to understand, to quote him correctly, and to represent his views in such a way that readers might look into Christianity. It was clear that Williams wasn't buying it personally. If Rayford had to guess, he'd say Williams was trying to hide a smirk, or else he was so amused or amazed that he couldn't frame a response. Rayford had to remind himself that his purpose was to get through to Chloe first, and then maybe to influence the reading public if the thing found its way into print. If Cameron Williams thought Rayford was totally out to lunch, he might just leave him out, along with all his cockamamie views. Buck did not trust himself to respond with coherence. He still had chills, yet he felt sticky with sweat. What was happening to him? He managed a whisper. "I want to thank you for your time and for dinner," he said. "I will get back to you before using any of your quotes." That was nonsense, of course. He had said it only to give himself a reason to reconnect with the pilot. He might have a lot of personal questions about this, but he never allowed people he interviewed to see their quotes in advance. He trusted his tape recorder and his memory, and he had never been accused of misquoting. Buck looked back up at the captain and saw a strange look cross his face. He looked, what, disappointed? Yes, then resigned. Suddenly Buck remembered who he was dealing with. This was an intelligent, educated man. Surely he knew that reporters never checked back with their sources. He probably thought he was getting a journalistic brush-off. "A rookie mistake, Buck," he reprimanded himself. "You just underestimated your own source." Buck was putting his equipment away when he noticed Chloe was crying, tears streaming down her face. What was it with these women? Hattie Durham had been weeping when she and the captain had finished talking that afternoon. Now Chloe.
Buck could identify, at least with Chloe. If she was crying because she had been moved by her father's sincerity and earnestness, it was no surprise. Buck had a lump in his throat, and for the first time since he had lain face down in fear in Israel during the Russian attack, he wished he had a private place to cry.
"Could I ask you one more thing, off the record?" he said. "May I ask what you and Hattie were talking about this afternoon in the club?"
"Buck!" Hattie scolded. "That's none of your..."
"If you don't want to say, I'll understand," Buck said. "I was just curious."
"Well, much of it was personal," the captain said. "Fair enough. But, Hattie, I don't see any harm in telling him that the rest of it was what we just went over, do you?"
She shrugged.
"Still off the record, Hattie," Buck said. "Do you mind if I ask your reaction to all this?"
"Why off the record?" Hattie snapped. "The opinions of a pilot are important, but the opinions of a flight attendant aren't."
"I'll put you on the machine if you want," he said. "I didn't know you wanted to be on the record."
"I don't," she said. "I just wanted to be asked. It's too late now."
"And you don't care to say what you think?"
"No, I'll tell you. I think Rayford is sincere and thoughtful. Whether he's right, I have no idea. That's all beyond me and very foreign, but I am convinced he believes it. Whether he should or not, with his background and all that, I don't know. Maybe he's susceptible to it because of losing his family."
Buck nodded, realizing he was closer to buying Rayford's theory than Hattie was. He glanced at Chloe, hoping she had composed herself and that he could draw her out. She still had a tissue pressed under her eyes.
"Please don't ask me right now," she said.
Rayford was not surprised at Hattie's response, but he was profoundly disappointed with Chloe's. He was convinced she didn't want to embarrass him by saying how off the wall he sounded. He should have been grateful, he guessed. At least she was still sensitive to his feelings. Maybe he should have been more sensitive to hers, but he had decided he couldn't let those gentilities remain priorities anymore. He was going to contend for the faith with her until she made a decision. For tonight, however, it was clear she had heard enough. He would not be pushing her any more. He only hoped he could sleep despite his remorse over her condition. He loved her so much. "Mr. Williams," he said, standing and thrusting out his hand, "it's been a pleasure. The pastor I told you about in Illinois really has a handle on this stuff and knows much more than I do about the Antichrist and all. It might be worth a call if you want to know any more. Bruce Barnes, New Hope Village Church, Mount Prospect."
"I'll keep that in mind," Buck said.
Rayford was convinced Williams was merely being polite. Talking to this Barnes was a great idea, Buck thought. Maybe he'd find the time the next day in Chicago. That way he could pursue this for himself and not confuse the professional angle with his own interest. The foursome moseyed to the lobby.
"I'm going to say my good nights," Hattie said. "I've got the earlier flight tomorrow."
She thanked Rayford for dinner, whispered something to Chloe, which seemed to get no response, and thanked Buck for his hospitality that morning.
"I may just call Mr. Carpathia one of these days," she said.
Buck resisted the urge to tell her what he knew about Carpathia's immediate future. He doubted the man would have time for her. Chloe looked as if she wanted to follow Hattie to the elevators and yet wanted to say something to Buck as well. He was shocked when she said,
"Give us a minute, will you, Daddy? I'll be right up."
Buck found himself flattered that Chloe had hung back to say goodbye personally, but she was still emotional. Her voice was quavery as she formally told him what a good time she had had that day. He tried to prolong the conversation.
"Your dad is a pretty impressive guy," he said.
"I know," she said, "especially lately."
"I can see why you might agree with him on a lot of that stuff."
"You can?"
"Sure. I have a lot of thinking to do myself. You give him a hard time about it, though, huh?
I used to. Not anymore.
Why not?
You can see how much it means to him.
Buck nodded. She seemed on the edge emotionally again. He reached to take her hand. It's been wonderful spending time with you, he said. She chuckled, as if embarrassed about what she was thinking.
What?
He pressed.
Oh, nothing. It's silly.
Come on, what? We've both been silly today.
Well, I feel stupid, she said. I just met you and I'm really gonna miss you.
If you get through Chicago, you have to call.
It's a promise, Buck said.
I can't say when, but let's just say sooner than you think. Chapter 22. Buck did not sleep well. Partly he was excited about his morning surprise. He could only hope Chloe would be happy about it. The larger part of his mind reeled with wonder. If this was true, all that Rayford Steele had postulated, and Buck knew instinctively that if any of it was true, all of it was true, why had it taken Buck a lifetime to come to it? Could he have been searching for this all the time, hardly knowing he was looking? Yet even Captain Steele, an organized analytical airline pilot, had missed it, and Steele claimed to have had a proponent, a devotee, almost a fanatic, living under his own roof. Buck was so restless he had to leave his bed and pace. Strangely, somehow, he was not upset, not miserable. He was simply overwhelmed. None of this would have made a bit of sense to him just days before, and now, for the first time since Israel, he was unable to separate himself from his story. The Holy Land attack had been a watershed event in his life. He had stared his own mortality in the face, and had to acknowledge that something otherworldly, yes, supernatural, something directly from God Almighty, had been thrust upon those dusty hills in the form of a fire in the sky. And he had known beyond a doubt for the first time in his life that unexplainable things out there could not be dissected and evaluated scientifically from a detached Ivy League perspective. Buck had always prided himself on standing apart from the pack, for including the human, the everyday, the everyman element in his stories when others resisted such vulnerability. This skill allowed readers to identify with him, to taste and feel and smell those things most important to them. But he had still been able, even after his closest brush with death, to let the reader live it without revealing Buck's own deep angst about the very existence of God. Now that separation seemed impossible. How could he cover this most important story of his life, one that had already probed closest to his soul, without subconsciously revealing his private turmoil? He was, he knew by the wee hours, leaning over the line. He wasn't ready to pray yet, to try to talk to a God he had ignored for so long. He hadn't even prayed when he became convinced of God's existence that night in Israel. What had been the matter with him? Everyone in the world, at least those intellectually honest with themselves, had to admit there was a God after that night. Amazing coincidences had occurred before, but that had defied all logic. To win against the mighty Russians was an upset, of course, but Israel's history was replete with such legends. Yet to not defend yourself and suffer no casualties? That was beyond all comprehension, apart from the direct intervention of God. Why, Buck wondered, hadn't that made more of an impact on his own introspective inventory? In the lonely darkness, he came to the painful realization that he had long ago compartmentalized this most basic of human needs and had rendered it a non-issue. What did it say about him? What despicable kind of a subhuman creature had he become that even the stark evidence of the Israel miracle, for it could be called nothing less, had not thawed his spirit's receptiveness to God? Not that many months later came the great disappearance of millions around the world. Dozens had vanished from the plane in which he was a passenger. What more did he need? It already seemed as if he were living in a science fiction thriller. Without question, he had lived through the most cataclysmic event in history. Buck realized he'd not had a second to think in the last 2 weeks. Had it not been for the personal tragedies he had witnessed, he might have been more private in his approach to what appeared to be a universe out of control. He wanted to meet this Bruce Barnes, not even pretending to be interviewing him for an article. Buck was on a personal quest now, looking to satisfy deep needs. For so many years, he had rejected the idea of a personal God or that he had need of God, if there was one. The idea would take some getting used to. Captain Steele had talked about everyone being a sinner. Buck was not unrealistic about that. He knew his life would never stand up to the standards of a Sunday school teacher. But he had always hoped that if he faced God someday, his good would outweigh his bad, and that, relatively speaking, he was as good or better than the next guy. That would have to do. Now, if Rayford Steele and all his Bible verses could be believed, it didn't make any difference how good Buck was or where he stood in relation to anybody else. One archaic phrase had struck him and rolled around in his head. There is none righteous, no, not one. Well, he had never considered himself righteous. Could he go the next level and admit his need for God, for forgiveness, for Christ? Was it possible? Could he be on the cusp of becoming a born-again Christian? He had been almost relieved when Rayford Steele had used that term. Buck had read, even written about, those kinds of people. But even at his level of worldly wisdom, he had never quite understood the phrase. He had always considered the born-again label akin to ultra-right-winger or fundamentalist. Now, if he chose to take a step he had never dreamed of taking, if he could not somehow talk himself out of this truth he could no longer intellectually ignore, he would also take upon himself a task. Educating the world on what that confusing little term really meant. Buck finally dozed on the couch in his living room, despite a lamp shining close to his face. He slept soundly for a couple of hours, but awoke in time to get to the airport. The prospect of surprising Chloe and traveling with her gave him a rush that helped overcome his fatigue. But even more exciting was the possibility that another answer man awaited him in Chicago, a man he trusted simply on the recommendation of a pilot who had seemed to speak the truth with authority. It would be fun someday to tell Rayford Steele how much that otherwise innocuous interview had meant to him. But Buck assumed Steele had already figured that out. That was probably why Steele had seemed so passionate. If this signaled the soon beginning of the tribulation period predicted in the Bible, and Rayford had no doubt that it did, he wondered if there would be any joy in it. Bruce didn't seem to think there would be, aside from the few converts they might be privileged to win. So far, Rayford felt he was a failure. While he was certain God had given him the words and the courage to say them, he felt he had done something wrong in communicating to Hattie. Maybe she was right. Maybe he had been self-serving. It had to appear to her that he was merely getting out from under his own load of guilt. But he knew better. Before God, he believed his motives pure. Yet clearly he had not persuaded Hattie of more than that he was sincere and that he believed. What good was that? If he believed and she didn't, she had to assume he believed something bogus, or she would have to admit she was ignoring the truth. What he had told her carried no other option. And his performance during the interview with Cameron Williams. At the time, Rayford had felt good about it, articulate, calm, rational. He knew he was discussing revolutionary, jarring stuff, but he felt God had enabled him to be lucid. Yet, if he couldn't get any more reaction out of the reporter than polite deference, What kind of a witness could he be? From the depths of his soul, Rayford wanted to be more productive. He felt he had wasted his life before this, and he had only a short period to make up for lost time. He was eternally grateful for his own salvation, but now he wanted to share it, to bring more people to Christ. The magazine interview had been an incredible opportunity, but in his gut he felt it had not come off well. Was it even worth the effort to pray for another chance? Rayford believed he had seen the last of Cameron Williams. He wouldn't be calling Bruce Barnes, and Rayford's quotes would never see the pages of Global Weekly. As Rayford shaved and showered and dressed, he heard Chloe packing. She had obviously been embarrassed by him last night, probably even apologized to Mr. Williams for her father's absurd ramblings. At least she had tapped on his door and said good night when she came in. That was something, wasn't it? Every time Rayford thought of Chloe, he felt a tightness in his chest, a great emptiness and grief. He could live with his other failures if he must, but his knees nearly buckled as he prayed silently for Chloe. I cannot lose her, he thought, and he believed he would trade his own salvation for hers if that was what it took. With that commitment, he sensed God speaking to him, impressing upon him that that was precisely the burden required for winning people, for leading them to Christ. That was the attitude of Jesus himself, being willing to take on himself the punishment of men and women so they could live. Rayford was emboldened anew as he prayed for Chloe, still fighting the nagging fear of failure. God, I need encouragement, he breathed. I need to know I haven't turned her off forever. She had said good night, but he had also heard her crying in bed. He emerged in uniform and smiled at her as she stood by the door, dressed casually for travel. Ready, sweetie? He said tentatively. She nodded and seemed to work up a smile, then embraced him tight and long, pressing her cheek against his chest. Thank you, he prayed silently, wondering if he should say anything. Was this the time? Dare he press now? Again he felt deeply impressed of God, as if the Lord were speaking directly to his spirit. Patience, let her be, let her be. Keeping silent seemed as hard as anything he had ever done. Chloe said nothing either. They grabbed a light breakfast and headed to JFK. Chloe was the first passenger on the plane. I'll try to get back and see you, Rayford told her before heading to the cockpit. Don't worry if you can't, she said. I'll understand. Buck waited until everyone else had boarded. As he approached his seat next to Chloe, her body was turned toward the window, arms crossed, chin in her hand. Whether she even had her eyes open, Buck couldn't tell. He assumed she would turn to glance as he sat next to her, and he couldn't suppress a smile, anticipating her reaction, and only slightly worried that she would be less positive than he hoped. He sat and waited, but she didn't turn. Was she sleeping? Staring? Meditating? Praying? Was it possible she was crying? Buck hoped not. He already cared for her enough to be bothered when she seemed in pain. And now he had a problem. As he warily watched for the change in position that would allow Chloe to see him in her peripheral vision, he was suddenly awash in fatigue. His muscles and joints ached, his eyes burned, his head felt like lead. No way was he going to fall asleep and have her discover him dozing next to her. Buck gestured to get the attendant's attention. "Coke, please," he whispered. The temporary caffeine rush would allow him to stay awake a little longer. When Chloe didn't move even to watch the safety instructions, Buck grew impatient. Still, he didn't want to reveal himself. He wanted to be discovered, and so he waited. She must have grown weary of her position because she stretched and used her feet to push her carry-on bag under the seat in front of her. She took a last sip of her juice and set it on the small tray between them. She stared at Buck's glove-leather boots, the ones he had worn the day before. Chloe's eyes traveled up to his smiling, expectant face. Her reaction was more than worth the wait. She folded her hands and drew them to her mouth, her eyes filling. Then she took his hand in both of hers.
"Oh, Buck," she whispered. "Oh, Buck."
"It's nice to see you, too," he said. Chloe quickly let go of his hand as if catching herself.
"I don't mean to act like a schoolgirl," she said, "but have you ever received a direct answer to prayer?"
Buck shot her a double take. "I thought your dad was the praying member of your family."
"He is," she said, "but I just tried out my first one in years and God answered it."
"You prayed I would sit next to you?"
"Oh, no, I never would have dreamed of anything that impossible. How did you do it, Buck?"
He told her. "It wasn't hard once I knew your flight time, and I said I was traveling with you to get next to you."
"But why? Where are you going?"
"You don't know where this plane's going?" "San Jose, I hope," she laughed. "But come on now, Chloe, finish your story. I've never been an answer to prayer before."
"It's kind of a long story."
"I think we've got time."
She took his hand again. "Buck, this is too special. This is the nicest thing anyone's done for me in a long time."
"You said you were going to miss me, but I didn't do it only for you. I've got business in Chicago." She giggled and let go again.
"I wasn't talking about you, Buck, though this is sweet. I was talking about God doing the nice thing for me."
Buck couldn't hide his embarrassment.
"I knew that," he said.
And she told him her story.
"You might have noticed I was pretty upset last night. I was so moved by my dad's story. I mean, I had heard it before, but all of a sudden he seemed so loving, so interested in people. Could you tell how important it was to him and how serious he was about it?"
"Who couldn't?"
"If I didn't know better, Buck, I would have thought he was trying to convince you personally rather than just answering your questions."
"I'm not so sure he wasn't."
"Did it offend you?"
"Not at all, Chloe. To tell you the truth, he was getting to me." Chloe fell silent and shook her head. When she finally spoke, she was nearly whispering, and Buck had to lean toward her to hear. He loved the sound of her voice.
"Buck," she said, "he was getting to me, too. And I don't mean my dad."
"Too bizarre," he said. "I was up half the night thinking about this."
"It won't be long for either of us, will it?" she said.
Buck didn't respond, but he knew what she meant. "When do I get to be the answer to prayer?" he prodded.
"Oh, right. I was sitting there at dinner with my dad pouring his guts out to you, and I suddenly realized why he wanted me to be there when he said the same things to Hattie. I gave him such a hard time at first that he backed off on me, and now that he had the knowledge and the real need to convince me, he was afraid to come right at me. He wanted me to get it indirectly. And I did. I didn't hear how he started because Hattie and I were in the ladies' room, but I had probably heard that before. When I got back, I was transfixed. It wasn't that I was hearing anything new. It was new to me when I heard it from Bruce Barnes and saw that videotape, but my dad showed such urgency and confidence. Buck, there's no other explanation for those two guys in Jerusalem, is there, except that they have to be the two witnesses talked about in the Bible?"
Buck nodded.
"So Dad and God were getting to me, but I wasn't ready yet. I was crying because I love him so much and because it's true. It's all true, Buck. Do you know that?"
"I think I do, Chloe."
"But still I couldn't talk to my dad about it. I didn't know what was in my way. I've always been so blasted independent.
I knew he was frustrated with me, maybe disappointed, and all I could do was cry. I had to think, to try to pray, to sort it out. Hattie was no help. She doesn't get it, and maybe never will. All she cared about was trivial stuff, like trying to matchmake you and me.
Buck smiled and tried to look insulted. That's trivial.
Well, compared to what we're talking about right now, I'd have to say so.
Gotta give you that one, Buck said.
She laughed. So I knew something was wrong with Dad because I talked to you for only, what, 3 minutes or so before I went up?
Less than that, probably.
By the time I got to our suite, he was already in bed, so I told him good night just to make sure he was still talking to me. He was. And then I tossed and turned, not ready to take the last step, crying about my dad's worrying so much about me and loving me so much.
That's while I was up, probably, Buck said.
But, Chloe said, this is so out of character for me. Even though I'm there, I mean, I'm right there. You follow me?
Buck nodded. I've been going through the same thing.
I've been convinced, she said, but I'm still fighting. I'm supposed to be an intellectual. I have critical friends to answer to. Who's going to believe this? Who's going to think I haven't lost my mind?
Believe me, I understand, Buck said, amazed at the similarities between their journeys.
So I was stuck, she said. I wasn't getting anywhere. I tried to encourage my dad by not being so distant, but I could tell he saw me suffering, but I don't think he had any idea how close I was. I got on this plane desperate for some closure, pardon the psychobabble, and I started wondering if God answers your prayers before you're actually a...
Born-again Christian, Buck offered.
Exactly. I don't know why that's so hard for me to say. Maybe somebody who knows better can tell me for sure, but I prayed, and I think God answered. Tell me this, Buck, just with your cognitive reasoning skills. If there is a God, and if this is all true, wouldn't he want us to know? I mean, God wouldn't make it hard to learn, and he wouldn't, or I should say he couldn't, ignore a desperate prayer, could he?
I don't see how he could, no.
Well, that's what I think. So I think it was a good test, a reasonable one, and that I wasn't out of line. I'm convinced God answered.
And I was the answer.
And you were the answer.
Chloe, what exactly did you pray for?
Oh, well, the prayer itself wasn't that big of a deal until it was answered. I just told God I needed a little more. I felt bad that all the stuff I'd heard and all that I knew from my dad wasn't enough. I just prayed really sincerely and said I would appreciate it if God could show me personally that he cared, that he knew what I was going through, and that he wanted me to know he was there.
Buck felt a strange emotion, that if he tried to speak, his voice would be husky and he might be unable to finish a sentence. He pressed his hand over his mouth to compose himself. Chloe stared at him.
"And you feel I was the answer to that prayer?" he said at last. "No doubt in my mind. See, like I said, I wouldn't even have conceived of praying that you would wind up next to me on the biggest day of my life. I wasn't even sure I'd ever see you again, but it's as if God knew better than I did that there was no one I would rather see today than you."
Buck was touched, moved beyond expression. He had wanted to see her, too, otherwise he could have flown on Hattie's flight or any one of a dozen that would have gotten him to Chicago that morning. Buck just looked at her.
"So what are you going to do now, Chloe?
It seems to me that God has called your bluff. It wasn't a bluff, exactly, but you asked, and he delivered. Sounds like you're obligated."
"I have no choice," she agreed. "Not that I want one." From what I've gathered from Bruce Barnes and the tape and Dad, you don't have to have somebody lead you through this, and you don't have to be in a church or anything. Just like I prayed for a clearer sign, I can pray about this.
Your dad made that clear last night.
You want to join me? She asked.
Buck hesitated. Don't take this personally, Chloe, but I'm not ready.
What more do you need? Oh, I'm sorry, Buck. I'm doing just what my dad did the day he became a Christian. He could hardly help himself, and I was so awful to him. But if you're not ready, you're not ready.
I won't need to be forced, Buck said. Like you, I feel like I'm right on the doorstep. But I'm pretty careful, and I want to talk to this Barnes guy today. I have to tell you, though, my remaining doubts can hardly stand up to what's happening to you.
You know, Buck, Chloe said, I promise this will be the last thing I say about it. But I'm thinking the same way my dad did. I have this urge to tell you not to wait too long, because you never know what might happen.
I hear you, he said. I'm going to have to take my chances this plane won't go down, because I still feel I need to talk to Barnes. But you have a point. Chloe turned and looked over her shoulder.
There are two vacant seats right there, she said.
She stopped a passing attendant.
Can I give you a message for my dad?
Sure. Is he captain or first officer?
Captain. Please just tell him his daughter has extremely good news for him. Extremely good news, the attendant repeated.
Rayford was manually flying the plane as a diversion when his senior flight attendant gave him the message. He had no idea what it meant, but it was so unlike Chloe to initiate communication lately, he was intrigued. He asked his first officer to take over. Rayford unstrapped himself and made his way out, surprised to see Cameron Williams. He hoped Williams wasn't the extent of Chloe's good news. Pleasant as it was to think the man might already be making good on his promise to look up Bruce Barnes, Rayford also hoped that Chloe wasn't about to announce some ill-advised whirlwind romance in the bud. He shook hands with the writer and expressed his pleasant but wary surprise. Chloe reached for his neck with both hands and gently pulled him down to where she could whisper to him.
Daddy, could you and I sit back there for a couple of minutes so I can talk to you?
Buck sensed disappointment in Captain Steele's eyes at first. He looked forward to telling the pilot why he was glad to be flying to Chicago. Sitting next to Chloe had been only a bonus. He peeked back at Steele with his daughter, engaged in intense conversation and then praying together. Buck wondered if there was any airline regulation against that. He knew Rayford couldn't fraternize for long. In a few minutes, Chloe stepped into the aisle and Rayford stood and embraced her. They both appeared overcome with emotion. A middle-aged couple across the aisle leaned out and stared, brows raised. The captain noticed, straightened, and headed toward the cockpit. "My daughter," he said awkwardly, pointing at Chloe, who smiled through her tears. "She's my daughter." The couple looked at each other, and the woman spoke.
"Right, and I'm the Queen of England," she said,
and Buck laughed out loud. Chapter 23 Buck called New Hope Village Church to set up an early evening meeting with Bruce Barnes, then spent most of the afternoon at the Chicago Bureau of Global Weekly. News of his becoming their boss had swept the place, and he was greeted with coolness by Lucinda Washington's former assistant, a young woman in sensible shoes. She told him in no uncertain terms, "Plank did nothing about replacing Lucinda, so I assumed I would move into her slot." Her attitude and presumption alone made Buck say, "That's unlikely, but you'll be the first to know. I wouldn't be moving offices just yet."
The rest of the staff still grieved over Lucinda's disappearance and seemed grateful for Buck's visit. Steve Plank had hardly ever come to Chicago and had not been there since Lucinda had vanished. Buck camped out in Lucinda's old office, interviewing key people at 20-minute intervals. He also told each about his writing assignment and asked their personal theories of what had happened. His final question to each was, "Where do you think Lucinda Washington is right now?" More than half said they didn't want to be quoted, but expressed variations of, "If there's a heaven, that's where she is." Near the end of the day, Buck was told that CNN was live at the UN with big news. He invited the staff into the office, and they watched together. In the most dramatic and far-reaching overhaul of an international organization anyone can remember, came the report. Romanian President Nicolae Carpathia was catapulted into reluctant leadership of the United Nations by a nearly unanimous vote. Carpathia, who insisted on sweeping changes in direction and jurisdiction of the United Nations in what appeared an effort to gracefully decline the position, became Secretary General here just moments ago. As late as this morning, his press secretary and spokesman, Stephen Plank, former executive editor of the Global Weekly, had denied Carpathia's interest in the job and outlined myriad demands the Romanian would insist upon before even considering the position. Plank said the request for Carpathia's elevation came from outgoing Secretary General Mwangari Ngumo of Botswana. We asked Ngumo why he was stepping down. Nagumo's face filled the screen, eyes downcast, his expression carefully masked. "I have long been aware that divided loyalties between my country and the United Nations have made me less effective in each role. I had to choose, and I am first and foremost a Botswanian. We have the opportunity now to become prosperous, due to the generosity of our friends in Israel. The time is right, and the new man is more than right. I will cooperate with him to the fullest." "Would you, sir, have stepped down had Mr. Carpathia declined the position?" Ngumo hesitated. "Yes," he said, "I would have. Perhaps not today, and not with as much confidence in the future of the United Nations, but yes, eventually." The CNN reporter continued. In only a matter of hours, every request Carpathia had outlined in an early morning press conference was moved as official business, voted upon, and ratified by the body. Within a year, the United Nations headquarters will move to New Babylon. The makeup of the Security Council will change to 10 permanent members within the month, and a press conference is expected Monday morning in which Carpathia will introduce several of his personal choices for delegates to that body. There is no guarantee, of course, that even member nations will unanimously go along with the move to destroy 90% of their military strength and turn over the remaining 10% to the UN. But several ambassadors expressed their confidence in equipping and arming an international peacekeeping body with a thoroughgoing pacifist and committed disarmament activist as its head. Carpathia himself was quoted as saying, "The UN will not need its military might if no one else has any, and I look forward to the day when even the UN disarms." Also coming out of today's meetings was the announcement of a 7-year pact between UN members and Israel, guaranteeing its borders and promising peace. In exchange, Israel will allow the UN to selectively franchise the use of the fertilizer formula developed by Nobel Prize winner Dr. Chaim Rosenzweig, which makes desert sands tillable and has made Israel a top exporter. Buck stared as CNN broadcast Rosenzweig's excitement and unequivocal endorsement of Carpathia. The news also carried a report that Carpathia had asked several international groups already in New York for upcoming meetings to get together this weekend to hammer out proposals, resolutions, and accords. "I urge them to move quickly toward anything that contributes to world peace and a sense of global unity. A reporter asked Carpathia if that included plans for one world religion and eventually one world government. His response, "I can think of little more encouraging than the religions of the world finally cooperating. Some of the worst examples of discord and infighting have been between groups whose overall mission is love among people. Every devotee of pure religion should welcome this potential. The day of hatred is past. Lovers of humankind are uniting." The CNN anchor continued, "Among other developments today, these are rumors of the organization of groups espousing one world government. Carpathia was asked if he aspired to a position of leadership in such an organization. Carpathia looked directly into the network pool camera and with moist eyes and thick voice said, "I am overwhelmed to have been asked to serve as Secretary General of the United Nations. I aspire to nothing else. While the idea of one world government resonates deep within me, I can say only that there are many more qualified candidates to lead such a venture. It would be my privilege to serve in any way I am asked, and while I do not see myself in the leadership role, I will commit the resources of the United Nations to such an effort, if asked." Smooth, Buck thought, his mind reeling. As commentators and world leaders endorsed one world currency, one language, and even the largesse of Carpathia expressing his support for the rebuilding of the temple in Israel, the staff of Global Weekly's Chicago Bureau seemed in a mood to party. "This is the first time in years I've felt optimistic about society," one reporter said. Another added, "This has to be the first time I've smiled since the disappearances. We're supposed to be objective and cynical, but how can you not like this? It'll take years to affect all this stuff, but someday, somewhere down the line, we're going to see world peace. No more weapons, no more wars, no more border disputes or bigotry based on language or religion. Phew! Who'd have believed it would come to this?" Buck took a call from Steve Plank. "You've been watching what's going on?" Plank said. "Who hasn't? Pretty exciting, isn't it?" "Mind-boggling. Listen, Carpathia wants you here Monday morning." "What for?" "He likes you, man. Don't knock it. Before the press conference, he's going to have a meeting with his top people and the 10 delegates to the Permanent Security Council."
"And he wants me there?"
"Yep. And you can guess who some of his top people are."
"Tell me."
"Well, one's obvious. Stonegal."
"Of course.
And Todd Cothran. I assume he'll move in as new ambassador from the UK.
"Maybe not,"
Steve said. "Another Brit is there. I don't know his name, but he's also with this international finance group Stonegal runs."
"You think Carpathia told Stonegal to have someone else in the wings in case Carpathia wants to squeeze Todd Cothran out?"
"Could be, but nobody tells Stonegal anything."
"Not even Carpathia?"
"Especially not Carpathia. He knows who made him, but he's honest and sincere, Buck. Nikolai will not do anything illegal or underhanded or even too political. He's pure, man, pure as the driven snow. So can you make it?"
"Guess I'd better. How many press will be there?
You ready for this?" "Only you."
"You're kidding."
"I'm serious. He likes you, Buck."
"What's the catch?"
"No catch. He didn't ask for a thing, not even favorable coverage. He knows you have to be objective and fair. The media will get the whole scoop at the press conference afterward."
"Obviously, I can't pass this up," Buck said, aware his voice sounded flat.
"What's the matter, Buck? This is history. This is the world the way we've always wanted it and hoped it would be."
"I hope you're right."
"I'm right. There's something else Carpathia wants."
"So there is a catch."
"No, nothing hinges on this. If you can't do it, you can't do it. You're still welcome Monday morning. But he wants to see that stewardess friend of yours again."
"Steve, no one calls them stews anymore. They're flight attendants."
"Whatever. Bring her with you if you can."
"Why doesn't he ask her himself? What am I now, a pimp?"
"Come on, Buck, it's not like that. Lonely guy in a position like this, he can't be out hustling up dates.
You introduced them, remember? He trusts you.
He must, Buck thought, if he's inviting me to this big pre-press conference meeting.
I'll ask her, he said. No promises. Don't let me down, buddy.
Rayford Steele was as happy as he had been since his own decision to receive Christ. To see Chloe smiling, to see her hungry to read Irene's Bible, to be able to pray with her and talk about everything together was more than he had dreamed of. "One thing we need to do," he said, "is to get you your own Bible. You're going to wear that one out."
"I want to join that core group of yours," she said. "I want to get all the stuff from Bruce firsthand. The only part that bothers me is that it sounds like things are going to get worse."
Late in the afternoon, they dropped in on Bruce, who confirmed Chloe's view.
"I'm thrilled to welcome you into the family," he said. "But you're right. God's people are in for dark days. Everybody is. I've been thinking and praying about what we're supposed to do as a church between now and the glorious appearing."
Chloe wanted to know all about that, so Bruce showed her from the Bible why he believed Christ would appear in 7 years at the end of the tribulation. "Most Christians will be martyred or die from war, famine, plagues, or earthquakes," he said. Chloe smiled.
"This isn't funny," she said, "but maybe I should have thought of that before I signed on. You're going to have trouble convincing people to join the cause with that in your sign-up brochure."
Bruce grimaced. "Yes, but the alternative is worse. We all missed out the first time around. We could be in heaven right now if we'd listened to our loved ones. Dying a horrible death during this period is not my preference, but I'd sure rather do it this way than while I was still lost. Everyone else is in danger of death, too. The only difference is we have one more way to die than they do."
"As martyrs."
"Right." Rayford sat listening, aware how his world had changed in such a short time. It had not been that long ago that he had been a respected pilot at the top of his profession, living a phony life, a shell of a man. Now here he was talking secretly in the office of a local church with his daughter and a young pastor, trying to determine how they would survive 7 years of tribulation following the rapture of the church. "We have our core group," Bruce said. "And Chloe, you're welcome to join us if you're serious about total commitment."
"What's the option?" she said.
"If what you're saying is true, there's no room for dabbling."
"You're right. But I've also been thinking about a smaller group within the core. I'm looking for people of unusual intelligence and courage. I don't mean to disparage the sincerity of others in the church, especially those on the leadership team. But some of them are timid, some old, many infirm. I've been praying about sort of an inner circle of people who want to do more than just survive."
"What are you getting at?" Rayford asked. "Going on the offensive?"
"Something like that. It's one thing to hide in here, studying, figuring out what's going on so we can keep from being deceived. It's great to pray for the witnesses springing up out of Israel, and it's nice to know there are other pockets of believers all over the world. But doesn't part of you want to jump into the battle?"
Rayford was intrigued, but not sure. Chloe was more eager.
"A cause," she said. "Something not just to die for, but to live for."
"Yes."
"A group, a team, a force," Chloe said.
"You've got it. A force." Chloe's eyes were bright with interest.